All right. So this new API was designed, why this solution exists. So originally the issue came from the Linux native clients at work. So we were trying, so one of the requirements is to not use proc. So upstream they said no more proc. They've been cleaning out proc in the Linux kernel for some time. So this impacted Lustre. Well, they have strict rules about migrating to from proc to SysFS and DebugFS. So SysFS was no problem, it's pretty transparent, but DebugFS had a root-only issue, so it's mounted only as root, and it's only encouraged that way because DebugFS is traditionally used only for debugging. So the items that are exposed are not considered safe. So this started to impact our tools, and so examples like lcuddle DL, which lists all the devices and stats, people started reporting these issues as we moved to DebugFS. So from that, we were like, well, we need to present this data to users. So tunables in general in Lustre, in the proc system or DebugFS, try to present it in YAML. So I said, well, we could use a YAML solution for this and present it as actual YAML docs. So then, but it was originally for that solution. And then CEA actually proposed replacing there's a file pipe for HSM, and they did a netlink solution, which is the proper way to do it, and it also has a big performance improvement. So at this point, we were like, wait, we could do a generalized solution for everything.
Go ahead. That's right.
Yeah. So this solution actually started to be like, oh, we can use it for HSM and present it. And then we moved to the next third issue, which we saw was netlink tools. So LNet Cuddle is a tool that's used. They're changing that API to the user land all the time. So that Octal is constantly changing its format. So if you try to use the tool with older versions of Lustre, you can crash the kernel and other things like that because the Octal format is changing and it's not aware of these changes. So when I started to design this API, I said, well, what if we kind of make the API so that it can handle any changes and you never have to create a new iOctal for these changes? It's a constant evolving API. It's an ABI for unstable ABIs. So that was the goal. And then IP version 6 came along, and we were looking at all the LNet config code, and we were just like, there's a huge amount of iOctals for pre-multi-rail and multi-rail. And then with IP6, it would be like all those iOctals would have to be rewritten. There's over 60 iOctals. There are other things, other benefits that we saw with Netlink. One was that iOctals are limited in size. So they're like 8 or 6 kilobytes in size. With Netlink, you can send megabytes of amounts of data. You can multiplex the streams. So that's the other thing. So currently, like if you want stats, you're opening dozens or hundreds on larger scale systems of staff files to read them. With this, you open one Netlink socket and funnel all the stats through that one socket, and it comes all at one time. So that actually is a huge performance win on that. And then the third thing, which was an interesting feature, is it's actually container aware. So you can isolate the data that's sent based on the net namespace that you're in. So you can actually alter it and filter it. So there's a lot of useful features you can do with this that you don't get with the traditional iOctal.
James, I have a question. Can you tell us about the explosion of IOCTLs from IPv6?
Because
How many is it? Because the explosion is...
There's like over... I would say there's about 60 iOctals.
Okay.
So we would have to double that number for IP6. And that doesn't include, like, one of the goals is to support IB hardware remote addressing. So that's a 20 byte versus the 16 byte that IP version 6 uses. So that's why. So this would all unify the API under one thing.
Okay.
So when we looked at this, we were like, okay, we're going to use the libyaml library. So we have this library, and the nice thing about this library is that it actually validates your YAML code that you write. There have been times when we've done string parsing and it wasn't correct YAML. It's not proper YAML. So this will actually verify that it is proper YAML. So the nice thing about the libyaml library is people know how to do it. And it also works with Python. There's a Python wrapper available. So I was like, wow, we could either use CYAML, which is currently used by Lustre, and only Lustre. So everybody has to have this learning curve. Or we could just use the libyaml library directly, and everybody knows it, like out there in the world. There are people who've written this code. I know Robinhood has used this. So your code is just basically using that library functionality you already know. So you could interface with HSM with it. So there are only a couple new functions that have been added to interface that's new. One is that normally for the YAML parser and emitters, you open a file or buffer. We actually have to open a netlink socket with the emitter. And I go over later on what these flags are and stuff to do with this. So like, for example, the parser, we have the socket. That's all you need is the netlink socket. And there's a streaming flag. So one of the things you can do with this is that you can stream the data. So either it's a one-shot, you ask the parser to deliver the information, and then you can data mine it, or the data keeps coming over and over. A good example of that is the external coordinator work we're doing. It's like a daemon that just sits there and receives HSM events all the time, and it parses them. So, and with the emitter there, you have to open the socket, and you have to refer to the netlink family, the version of the protocol, and the command, and then the netlink flags. So it's very... The other thing I've added is error functionality. So the YAML, libyaml is not... It doesn't... There's a lot of error handling, so I made some helpers for you to make it easier. And also, you can ask the parser, the protocol API you're using for your netlink. So there's different versions of the netlink API you can use and define it. A good example of that is netlink itself. So the netlink command, when you look for the, when you do lnet cuddle net show, there's like dash V for the verbose up to 5 levels. I use that as the flag for web family version of the protocol to do. The same with Lustre stats. Actually, I can support and I can present the Lustre stats that have been presented in PROC in 3 different versions. So it depends what you want. So it's backwards compatible. You can say, oh, I want the older version of the stats. Or no, I want the one that was recently developed, or I want the latest. You can actually control which one you have. So the nice thing about this API is when you write your userland utilities, you don't have to update them if the kernel changes. It will work with any kernel, whatever netlink packets it's sent. So if there's data, if you're using a newer tool and your kernel is older and it doesn't send the data, the tool doesn't care. It will never see that data, so you don't have to worry about the tool misprinting or sending out wrong data. The reverse is true, too. If your tool is newer, if the reverse is also true, so either your application, the kernel's going to send you code that you don't recognize, and it will just not know how to deal with it, so it will ignore it. So either way, because of that, you will see the data in the older format with newer kernels and your older tools, or if you have a newer tool, it'll still present the data as older if it's not there. So now the trade-off is you have to actually have an in-depth understanding of YAML to do this, especially libyaml and how it works. You just can't do it like the old days of just string parsing and making strings up. YAML coding is hard. So, in fact, it's hard enough that I actually have cheated myself and developed a tool that generates pseudocode to write libyaml code based on your YAML config. You make your YAML config, you run it in my little application I have. I will check that in and share that. And it'll generate the pseudocode, say, this is what you got to write, and it says, this is valid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
YAML.
That's exactly what it is. Because there's lots of little tricks and nuances you don't realize with the library that you have to be aware of.
This is all user space,
though, right? This is all user space. This is the user space I'm describing. But I wanted to make it so it was the learning curve for the person in user land is very little if they know YAML. That was the goal.
But even more so, this is for like monitoring tools that are like slurping in lots of stats. So it would be something that would be done once for Grafana or something like that.
Yes.
Or, you know, I guess you could probably bolt this on the back side of CollectD or something like that.
Yes, you could very easily. Yeah.
Then everybody would benefit with using CollectD, right?
Yep. And you could use, if it has like a YAML interface, it's a wrapper around it with Perl or whatever module. It will work.
No, I'm just saying, I mean, CollectD, yeah. Lots of tools use CollectD to collect
yeah.
stats, right?
Yes.
So having an efficient interface to Lustre would be efficient, benefit all around.
Yep. So to understand that, now you have to understand what actually YAML is. So YAML is composed of sequences, which are equivalent to arrays. And then also you have mappings, and mappings are key and value pairs. And then, of course, those both sequences and mappings can be presented as flows or blocks. So flows are usually where you see the brackets or the curly brackets, and the blocks are usually by indentations. So, and then your most basic component is your scalar. So your scalar is your actual data type. So key and values are scalars in themselves, and the combination of a key and value scalar are a mapping. A bunch of scalars that are part of an array are sequences. So, and in this case, I presented an LNUT config file, and this is where the quiz I ask you, what is what? Who can identify a sequence there? No, that's a block. Yes, so blocks are represented by indentations. Sequences are the dash in front. Dash net and dash interfaces. Because in the old days, we had more than one interfaces. So as part of that, before we got rid of TC bonding. And then if you look at like a dash net type, you could have O2IB1 and then TCP. And that would be an array of all the data in there. Yes.
To be honest, I mean, my YAML understanding is very bad. And so I usually just, I have this website, YAML Online Parser. And I go there until jigger out stuff until it works. Until it parses as valid YAML, but I don't know what the right structure
don't,
is.
That's why I'm going to submit that application where it generates the proper code and the pseudocode, because most people don't know this stuff. And the only reason I know this is because I had to write this netlink interface. So I had to learn like the deepest, darkest secrets. And our API doesn't even support things like tags and anchors, which are other features of YAML. So that we don't support. Anchors are like a way for a YAML block to reference another YAML block. It's like a symlink. You can do symlinks in YAML.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The thing is, just because we can have things like that in YAML,
we don't have to. All right. So, the CTP. What do you think that one is? This is a trick question, actually. The very bottom line. That's correct, because it has quotations. So in the YAML API, that makes it a string. The reason this is done for LNUT config is because the C YAML library that Lustre has does not support flows. My code does support flows, so you don't need the quotations anymore. So that actually treats it as a sequential that is, without the quotes, is a sequential flow block. Yes, and...
So a Penglai is just going through, there's a couple of, you know, YAML-like files that are not valid, and so he's just going through and fixing a couple of them so that they are, you know, more correct.
Yeah. Yep.
But I mean, we should do that more consistently too, right? Like, I always try to get, if people are doing, you know, some complex output, right? I mean, if it's just a key value, you know, that's fine, right? But if anything that has multiple, you know, values, I say, instead of just making something up, you know, make it YAML, because then, you know, why not?
It's some format that's standardized, and yes, yeah. It's very easy to get it, yeah, wrong. And there's equivalence too. So that's flow block on the CPT could actually be written as a sequence. So it could be like a dash CTP colon, and then you would have dash 0, dash 1, dash 2. So those are equivalent. And I have written our library to accept either or. It knows how to handle, it looks at like if it was a flow or a sequence, and it'll treat them as equivalent. So you don't have to worry. Your YAML config doesn't have to be hard-coded to be that. Yeah. You could do your own style.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons I like YAML is because you can make it look decently human-readable while still being machine-parsable.
Yes.
Because, you know, lots of things, you know, I want them to be usable for people, like XML and stuff like that is just terrible, right, to read. You know, but as long as too the YAML isn't like too vertically spread out, right? Because if it doesn't fit on the screen, that's why, you know, some of the things like job stats and whatever, right, is horizontally, you know, formatted, right, as a, I guess, a block. Right?
Yeah.
So that you can get multiple values per line. But then at least you can see a screen full of text, you know, it looks like something that's, you know, a person can understand it. And then, you know, the machine can still parse it out.
Yep. So, and of course you see things like pure timeout 180. That's a mapping. That's a key value pair. So, as you know, in the libyaml library, there are three ways to present the data that's received to you. There's YAML token, YAML event, and YAML document. So, the thing about YAML token and YAML events, if you're not familiar, is that is a form of streaming. So when you get the data, you go through this loop and you read each component. YAML documents are actually storable, so you can actually, quote, dump the YAML document, or you can load it. In the parser terms, it's loading it. In the emitter terms, it's dumping it. So you can load that information and preserve the YAML document for later use. One thing to note about these data structures with the library is you can only process these structures once. I learned this the hard way with the external coordinator. So we would get these HML, these HSM documents that would contain the HSM action list, and I would go through it, and then I would pass that data later on to another function and then it would be like, oh, there's no data left. You ate it all. It consumes the data. So you have to be aware that if you're going to consume an item, you have to clone the document in the library. So be careful of that. That's one of the tricks. So that's how the data is presented. Now, the way it works is there are YAML parsers and YAML emitters. So a YAML parser, its job is to translate the source, be it a configuration file, netlink, an input buffer to an actual YAML format.
And by that, you mean like the in-memory data structure?
In-memory data structure, yeah. So, yes, yeah, so you're talking whatever source it is. So in the case of like LNET, configuring LNET, your YAML config file would be handed to a parser, and then it would translate it in the library into some internal form of YAML to be used. This is how we send the netlink messages to the kernel. So it also, the parser, in our case for netlink, reports the error back. So the parser will receive and report errors it supports that kind of functionality, and then from the kernel it actually tell you the exact reason why it failed. It'll say, well, I couldn't parse this field, things like that. So that's the parser. The emitter translates YAML into some format. It will write it out to a config file or a standard out or a netlink packet. And this is how we take our YAML documents that you create internally for our library and translate it to netlink packets to send to the kernel. So it takes it and translates it and modifies it. Nice thing about YAML is YAML is a tree structure, and netlink also supports sending a tree structure to the kernel. So there's I left a link there, https://pyyaml.org/wiki/lib/YAML. And it kind of gives you an idea. It gives you the basics of how to program this. This is a good example. You can find other ones online. So if you're not familiar how to use these data structures. And like I said, I will be submitting something that takes like a YAML config and validates it and turns it into YAML code for you to make your life easier. And here is an example of the pseudocode that we have here. So with netlink, how like I actually took a piece of what I did. In this case, you have to create your netlink socket. You have to initialize a parser to receive the netlink packets, as you can see. And then you set the input type to the netlink. And in this case, it's not streaming, so it's false. So this way that the parser, once you have the emitter set out the data, you can the parser will receive the reply, and it'll tell you either what you sent is garbage or it'll give you a valid response. Now note, you do not need a reply. There are some instances where you just send it off to do something, and you only need an emitter in that case, and you don't need to create your socket. But you will need a GenL connect to link your netlink socket properly, because that's what's done by the parser, does that internally. But if you're not using a parser, you have to do that yourself. So that's a caveat to notice if you're just sending a message to the kernel and you don't care about a response. In this case, this pseudocode, you do have a response. And then you initialize your emitter, and this is to send the request, and you set the output to netlink. And in this case, you have your socket, and then you have to name your netlink family you use. So,
is that a function that you created, the YAML emitter netlink?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And it's just a little bit confusing because it's also called YAML, right? Which makes it one, you think that it's part of the library.
It's part, right. I did that so to the person who's familiar at YAML, they would go, oh, I understand this set output netlink is like set output file. But you do need to link, it's an extension. Yes, this is part of the extension. That was, I mentioned earlier, I have a few extension functions because of this API is unique to Lustre. And you have to link to the lib netlink config library to use those extra extensions. And then you would open the emitter, and then you start your document process. So there's like YAML document start event. That's for every document, and then from there is your unique, and you have to bookmark it with YAML document event initialize, and then you when you do emitter close, it sends that data off, and then from there there's a emitter log error, so that's a handy helper function that will print out the error if any errors happened. And also, I handle parser log errors as well. And you can, those are all extra helper family functions I've done. And then you have to clean up the emitters and the parser and then close the netlink socket. So that's basically how your user land code will generally look, the skeleton. So I did dot, dot, dot to represent like your unique YAML document building. When you add your mappings and your scalers and things like that. So that's the basic user land code. For people who've worked with YAML and user land, that should be a very low learning curve. Now, NetLink is a different thing. That requires a little bit more. There's a couple things you need to know about user NetLink. So the way I wrote this API is you only need to know the bare minimum of NetLink user LAN code, because all that functionality of translating YAML to NetLink is done in the library. You don't have to worry about it. That does is to make your life easier. I realized it was a steep learning curve to learn how to create NetLink packets and stuff like that for you. So that's a huge amount. So if you want to know how to do that, I left the link there. So that is the link to the InfraDead account. I forgot what his name is. He's the maintainer of the library, so he's written lots of documentation how to write user LAN NetLink API. Now, if you wanted to, you could write your own non-YAML interface and collect this data, but you don't have to. So the important things to know when you're doing this is, like I said, you have to open your NetLink socket. So there's a NL socket allocate and a free. There are other functions to manage your socket, so you can set behavioral flags. Our library kind of does that for you, but if you really, really want to do something special and you know what you're doing, you can modify the socket. So in every NetLink, when you create a NetLink group interface, you create a family, you create groups, and you have commands. So families are what they sound like. Quotas, NetLink, Lustre would be a family. Groups are subcategories of that family, and groups are a way to use for message filtering. So this is for multi-broadcasting. So say if you wanted to do Lustre and you wanted to know the device list, right? There's the LKLDL, that's your device group. And then you want to do stats. You could actually register your actually attach to both groups and open a socket with YAML, and you'll receive data for stats and for your devices together. So you can multiplex it. If you didn't want to do that, say you had stats and you wanted to do broad stats, but then you said, oh, I want to exclude something, you can do that with the groups. You can manage the groups correctly to filter which stats you want. Even though the stats, so the fire hose you can kind of pinch. That's the best way to describe that. So yes, because you can get a lot. So now you understand that NetLink. And there's actually a nice little command. You can do genl-ctrl-list. It comes with the NetLink's utilities in Linux. And it'll list all the families and you'll see, and the groups. And you'll see like NetLink and Net and peers, for example. That would be example of groups. And for every family, you also have versioning, so you can control the version. So if you change the format, you should update the version number. You increment it by one. So every time you add something new. So that way you can keep track of where we're at for the APIs. Then the other important thing is the message flags themselves. So you have several flags that's used with the YAML NetLink interface. One is NLMF dump. So that's a special flag that says, just give me the information. This is like your show. Then there's NLMF create, which tells you to add something to an interface. So like say you wanted to create for like LNET, you want to create a new interface. That's what you would use. You would use NLMF create. So when you set the flag to zero, it means actually delete. So there's no NLMF delete. There should be, but it's zero. So those are the ones. There are even more special cases. There's NLMF replace. So say a good example of that would be like you're replacing your NIDs for your change logs on Lustre. So you can actually, it would come up and you could send it there and it would see that you have this new information you want to replace with the old one, like you're updating information for a particular. There's also F exclude, and that means don't do avoid using this, and then you can append data as well to a specific item. So you can expand the data that you're including. You can exclude data. A good example of exclude data is the LNet module loading. We can set it up to read the modconf string, and I use that exclude flag to say don't read that string. So that's a good example of its use. Does that make any sense, those flags? Everything? Do you have any questions? So you could write the code?
Thank you.
Now, all right, if you reviewed my patches, you could review them now.
Maybe.
Maybe. All right. So the most important thing now that we showed you how to do that is to understand the kernel code, since we hide it from user land. We only have to worry about it for the kernel. But the kernel code actually maps a lot to the user land at link handling. So they're very similar, so that way it's one to the other. So the most fundamental unit is the netlink attribute. So that is the building block of a message. So we've done special attributes we've created to handle this. So for parsing messages from user land, there are certain functions that we use. So the message that's being sent to the kernel, there's a function called nltype, and that will tell you what the format is, and we've created a special enum for sending that information. So basically, the information can be strings or an integer, and that's what I basically say, or a list. So there's strings, lists, and integers that we send, and that is what's going on behind the scene, so and being generated to send to the kernel. And the reason you need to know this is that when in the kernel side, when you receive a message from user land, this is what you have to look for. So you would have your switch statement, and it would say NL type, and you would say, oh, is this a scalar attra string or value? It's actually value. Or is it an int value? So it will tell you the differential between the two. Or is it a list? So there's an NL scalar attribute list. And I have them all in a special header, in a UAPI header in LNet. That's LNet-NL.h. And so you can actually see what these types are. So that's how you categorize the information, what it is coming in to interpret it. Now for those different types, you have NL string compare. So you want to compare the string values sometimes to some known, especially for keys, you know what the key is going to be, like NAT or interface or so. And then there's also NL next, and that like moves you over to the next attribute because the attributes are in a giant nested structure when they come in. And at the very top level, you have that right there, NL for each attribute, because the packet is just attribute, 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 attribute for all the way to the end. And so at the very top level, almost all your functions start with NA for each attribute. And then adder is what you get out of that list, and the params is the top. And then you have this message length that you got sent. And rem is like the offset into the array. So each time you go through it, the rem is updated as you're going through that that loop. And in each of those that you get for NL for each attribute, you look at NL type. And then from NL type, you can use the specific functions like NL string scopy for if it's a string, or NL gets sign 64. So to make our lives easier, all the integers are sent up there, sign 64, because that would be difficult to tell it, oh, it's 32, it's 16-bit value. So this way it's just easy for the YAML documentation to handle that. So those are the functions to get that. So and using NL get 64, it depends on the NLA type that you're using. Makes sense? I know, everybody has to see an example. and like look at this document, and then it'll make sense. I know if you looked at my patch, that one, Andreas, the 96-80. No, it's not 9,000, is it? It is pretty big, but for the device listening, yeah. And then, so that's for the message to parse from user land. Now, the message to send to user land, what you have to do is typically in NetLink, you create an enum list of attribute values. So you'll have a bunch of them. So normally in normal NetLink APIs, these enums are stored in a UAPI header. In the case of Lustre and LNet, we do not do that. And the reason we don't do that is the main reason is because there's no guarantee that the enums won't change over time. So this way, you as a user land application developer do not have to worry, oh, the API has changed, I have to update the user land code. You don't have to do that, actually. That makes your life much easier. So if something's removed, you don't care. If something's added and you don't update the application doesn't care. It's not going to break the application. It will care that you should really add it to the application to read that data if it's new data coming in, but... But what you don't know, yes, that's exactly right. So it's flexible in that way. It won't hurt you. So,
yeah, it wasn't 9,000. Yes. This one, the first one, 1,600.
It's 38,168, the patch. Yeah. Yeah. So in all attributes, the very first value enum is always set to zero, and it's always NAL unspecified. That is reserved for error handling. So always be aware of that, is that your first real attribute is going to be one. So the way to put that data into your message is with things like NAL put string, NAL put U8, U32, U64. So there are these special things that assert the data and pad it and align it to optimize it for the NetLink message to send back over the socket. There's also flags like NAL put flag. That's for booleans. And then there's even one that I didn't list there that I need to add for support for HSM, and that's binary. So HSM actually does a binary. It passes it from user land to the kernel to... some binary information, so that's unusual. So that's your most basic things, and that would be used to handle your scalar and key values. Now, the next important thing to understand is in NetLink is nested APIs. So this is how you do the equivalent of doing a mapping block in YAML or a sequence. So a nested array is basically, it's an array of data. So you create your message with your enum. So there's a special enum used just for the message to say, hey, this is a nested list. And you start that nest. And then in the for loop that you've created to collect the data, you start creating NL nest start. That's starting to add your attribute. It creates your attribute to put in that list. And the index, is usually starts at zero, and then you increment it, and then you add your data. So, and then in the nested list, that nested list can be composed of many pieces of data. So it can be composed of strings, integers. So it's like blocks and blocks of the data. No, this is for when you send the message from kernel to be converted into YAML.
Okay.
So this is the second part. This is the creating messages to send to user land.
Also, LNet config is really the one main.
Yes, I've tested it. I have a whole full implementation of that.
So this is where you would be able to rip out CYAML then?
Yes, it can replace it. In fact, that pseudocode I write you is about the equivalent I used for LNET to show the data. So.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not wedded to any particular library or anything like that. But
as long as.
It works, right? And,
yeah.
We're not, like, in terms of. I mean, it's not that many places where you parse and produce tons of YAML.
No.
I mean, there's a few places if you look at the import file, right?
Yeah.
Oh, trick question. Is this real? Anyways, it's like, we can still produce that without, just print the best text and grab it. Yes, formatting can be bad, right? And I did actually just CC you on some patches.
Yeah, I'm going to take a look at that.
But, for simple, a couple of key values, it's probably not worthwhile to fire up all of this stuff. Just produce a proc.
I wouldn't say that because it's pretty, it's not that expensive. I mean.
Right, it's more expensive than, print, seek, put.
It depends on, I remember the there's pros and cons, you're right. There is more coding involved, but it depends on what your trade-off is. Like I know that because at DebugFS, the issue is non-root. And then the other thing is the benefit, there is a performance gain on this because these messages are all put into a big packet and sent at once. So instead of opening hundreds of proc files or DebugFS files, you just open one socket. And you say, give me all this data through this one socket.
But you can't do that. You can't slurp a ton of proc stats out through this interface.
I can. With NetLink, yes. I can.
You could or you can.
I can.
So
yes.
You can read all of the.
Yes. I could do
stats
and
stuff like that, the proc stats from RPCs and all of that stuff.
Yep. In theory, yes. With one socket, yes.
In theory or in practice? I'm just curious.
So honestly, right now I have a patch that can do the MD stats. Okay. I can open every single OBD device, if it's hundreds of them, with one socket and send all the data for all those.
Okay, but you need to code that, right? It's not like it miraculously somehow sucks all of the stats out of
No, you have to do what I showed you. You have to open, you have to create a little YAML document that says, give me for all these parameters. And then it'll return for all those parameters. And it does support the same, star. It knows to do that device. There's a global match function in the kernel. And it just says, it will actually compare it and find all the device lists and build it. So yeah, there is more work, but there's more gain.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and there's been some discussion in the upstream kernel too. It's about how do we, get stats out of SysFS more efficiently, right? And some of the people are I have to open up. If you look at proc TID, there's 100,000 processes on this node. You have to open up, 500,000 files to get all of the information, right?
Yes.
And, of course, in typical upstream kernel, who would ever do that? And just make open more efficient.
So they have a solution. And this is how one of the ideas where I got the NetLink from, and it's called TaskStats. There's a NetLink API that does the equivalent of looking up what you just said with the proc. Because you know who actually found that this killed it was, believe it or not, Android phones do that.
Yeah.
They were opening thousands of proc files and reading that data, and they found it was killing their batteries. So they were we need something that's not as CPU, that's way more performant. And they developed this NetLink API, and they said, We don't have to open hundreds of proc files and drain our batteries. We can just open one NetLink socket and filter.
Is that merged in?
Yeah, that's merged in. Yeah.
Good. Yeah. Often, yeah, I remember, like, you know, we don't need a kernel debugger. You just look at the code for an hour, and then you understand it, right? And so then there was years of fighting about we don't need debuggers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just wondering if there was a similar problem with, we don't need to get all of these stats out of the kernel, we just, you know, whatever.
So, yes. So this is, that has been solved. And this that task stats inspired me this solution. So this is the same kind of thing. So like I said, it is more work, but way more benefits, especially performance-wise for this. And like I said, the user land code, there's also the idea of the lower learning curve for the external user. It's like, oh, I just have to know four additional functions from what I already do now. So that was the idea for that. So instead of learning C, YAML, or other things, so, yeah.
Yeah, I think the only reason we picked YAML was because it's small and we could just import it directly into the kernel.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, it was very easy. So yeah, that's how NetLink works. So. Now in the kernel, you have to set up these families. So there's a genel onregister and register. Usually you don't have to do this. You usually expand on an existing family. There's only two families currently that I use. There's a netlink and a luster family. But you can add as many as you want. If you had very specific stuff, you could do that. So you register this structure genel family. So the important, it has several data fields, like one is it does it support namespace, there's a Boolean for that, there's the name of the families and stuff. But the important one is ops, and nops, which is the number of operations, and mc groups, that's the multicast groups and the number of them. So there you list them. So for the multicast groups, you provide a name of that family. So an LNet would be net and peers and routes. So those are the groups. And those are, like I said, whatever group you join, you can listen to for events for that group. So the one restriction on our YAML files is that they all must start with the group name. So for NetLink, it is LNet. Or it would be devices or Luster. It would be some group, actually. So you have to give it a title. So there's a simple scalar. That's what that's considered when you have a name and a colon. That's called a simple scalar. And that is for the group. So when the library runs, it looks for anything that's in the very first field that has no indentation. It says, oh, that's a group. Register to listen to those NetLink groups. And that's how it works. So there's also genel operations. So these are the callback functions for NetLink. So there are actually four functions in newer kernels. There's start and there's done, which are optional functions to the dump it. So the dump it is to retrieve the data from the kernel. That's the NMLF dump. Start and done are special functions that expand that. So dump it, you could write everything in dump it, but to make it cleaner, I have start as a way to parse the options you want for the information you want to retrieve. Because sometimes you just want to retrieve all the information, but sometimes you want to filter it. So start is used for the filtering and creating a filter list, and then dump it does the filter list, and then done does the cleanup after the filter list. So that's for the cleanup, because you do allocations in start, and then those allocations are used in dump, and then you free those allocations in done. And then there's a function called doit, and that's the call to execute a request from user space. So like if you wanted to add a peer or delete a peer or things like that, or change the staff formats, you would use the doit function. So one is to retrieve information, and one is to actually perform a function. So how do you handle, so this is, now we're going to talk about how to handle these command messages. So this is an example of how command message, here's the, so I've been working on LNET with this for the IP version 6. So that's LNET net command. So the important things is you get an SK buffer, which is a flexible a memory buffer for to handle network messaging. It's very optimized, actually, because since it's being used for like TCP handling. So, and then you have your GenL information, which contains a lot of details about your generic netlink interface. So the important thing from the SK buffer is you extract the netlink message header. So that's the first thing. And then the netlink message header, after the header, is a generic message header. So netlink packets start with... Yes. Yes, it is. So you have... Oh, this is a netlink message. Oh, it's a generic netlink message.
That's a LNET message. It's a specific LNET config message.
And then you have your parameters. Well, actually, you can actually insert a custom message handler, but I never have done that for this API. So theoretically, you can have a netlink message header, a generic message link header, your own message header, and then your attributes. So you grab your attributes. So once you have those, so the goofy thing about the API is you don't test to see if parameters is null. Parameters will be some weird pointer. I found this out the hard way. So you have to look at the message length, which will be zero. So you actually have to look at the message length to know that the attributes you gathered from the message header is actually valid. So be careful of that. So and then from there you can use that parameters list for the parsing. Usually it's NL for each attribute. There's another way to do it. So if you have a simple, since you were asking about like very simple netlink APIs, you can do a very simple one. And the GenL info that you got sent has an attributes field. So if you only sent a couple attributes, it's stored in there directly, so you don't have to grab the netlink header and stuff. You can actually just parse that. A good example of that is LNET self-test. I have a LNET session command, and that's very simple because that's basically what's the name of your session, what's the timeout.
Okay, so this is going to replace the broken binary interface for LNET self-test.
Yes, that is correct. LNET self-test will take a YAML file to run stuff.
So you could actually pass those around, like, here, run this LNET self-test test and here's the YAML file that will do all the things.
Yep.
I guess it's excluding the fact that we don't know what their network address is, right?
Correct. There, well, you would add it in the...
I was just thinking if there was something, you know, like FIO tests runs, right,
Oh, no, but we have that infrastructure. You can do that. You'll be able to say that.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, yep.
It's a free replacement of the NSF test.
It will look the same. And the old interface where you type in each command, mm-hmm. you'll still be able to do that. But internally, it's going to be building a YAML doc to send it. Because I don't want to break people's scripts. Everything I do is backwards compatible. Oh. I hide everything from everybody. So, but YAML self-test, you'll be able to print out that YAML file and stuff when you do it. You'll be able to say, oh yeah, what is that YAML file? So that's a good example. So like you said, you don't have to write super complicated LNET code for parsing. In some cases, like for setting up a netlink, sending up a LNET configuration file, yes, that is really complicated. Self-test, not so complicated. It's pretty simple. There's error handling. So there's, in the case of the commands, there's a Janelle set error message. So you can actually send a string. And when the error is reported, that error is actually sent back to the library. And your YAML parser will see that error. And you can print that exact error. So it can say, well, this attribute is wrong. So it's very specific. So the kernel is actually telling you. No, it's
enough for everybody.
Nope. You can get detailed error messages now. So this is one of the nice things, because then otherwise usually you'd be like, what does this mean? I know some of those LNET error messages are like cryptic.
Yeah.
Like, why is that? So yeah. So commands, the nice thing about commands is that not only can you report just the error state success in that, you can actually send replies too. So commands can actually send, and a good example is the session. So when the session's set up, you send in the session name and the timeout, but LNET needs a session ID, the LNET self-test. So when the message comes back, it says what the session ID is with what the original configuration is to let you know that it accepted that configuration. So you actually get a full message reply besides just error conditions. And like I said, LNET session command is a good example of this. So I'm going to go over how to construct a message with dump messages, because it's very similar to what I'm describing here. So you basically, for your message, you do a Janelle message new, and you create your message, and then you put all your attributes in there, your nested list, whatever you want. And then the difference between dump message and commands is that dump messages puts the message together for you for the reply and sends it, so you don't have to worry about it. But in the command case of Netlink, you have to actually tell it, this is a reply. And then there's an ML put at the end of the message that tells you, you have to specify certain flags for it. So the important thing to know, there's special flags for this. You have to tell it that the message is done. There's an ML message done. And you say, okay, this is the end of the message. Because Netlink sees all these attributes, but it doesn't know when the message is done. You have to explicitly tell. You also have to tell what kind of message it is. So Netlink messages, it allocates buffers of a certain size in the kernel. But your messages can be bigger than that. So what happens is that the message gets split up and can be sent in pieces to be reassembled. So there's a special flag that says this is a multi-packet message. Please assemble it back at the other end. And we handle that on the user land side. So the messages are all put together, and it appears as one message, even though it might be multiple messages. So in the case of dump messages, there's a start and done, which are the optional functions, as I was telling you. So the first thing you need is a dump context. So in the old days of the kernel, there's something called a netlink callback that's one of the arguments to this function. As you can see in LNET net show start, there's a callback. And that callback is a set of args. And it went from arg0 to arg6. Well, they found that people needed even more than 6 args. So they said, this is too hard. We just want to pass one data structure. So that's only in newer kernels. So to be backwards compatible, we just create a data structure, a dump context to be used with arg0. But in like newer kernels, we would just set it to this new.
What's the boundary there
in kernel versions? 5.8? Yeah, it's like a 5 something.
It's new enough that we
correct, because of RHEL 8, the 4.18, yeah. We have to use the arg0. So you would, and then you create a special inline function to grab this context from the callback.
So instead of having 10 arguments and 10 arguments, you just stuff 10 of them into arg0.
Yes. That's what I'm doing. Hey, that's the way they handle it. So that's what we do. But it makes your life easier. I find that doing a data structure, because that way you don't have to constantly, is ARG2 being used? Is ARG3? So it's kind of nice that way. Every context must track the index into the data we are because of the messages. So like I said, there's an MLF multiple messages. So when you go in your for loop, you have to actually say, I'm at position 5, I'm at position 6. And then if it runs out and it has to exit the function, it gets called again. You have to go remember where that index is. So when it comes back in and it goes, okay, I have to spin up to where we were at last time and then start filling in. So in the start function, the callback has the generic message header, so you have to grab that data. There's also, for error handling on the callback, there's the extended ACK. That's how you report your message. So there's a netlink extended ACK. And that is taken and used to fill in the error message. So there's a special netlink error message that you use in this case to fill that in and to that stack. So you have to get the message length, and just like all the other netlink, you have to look at the message length. And if it's in this case, message length of 0 is valid. That just says get everything. So like in the case of LNet show, you don't have to pass anything, and it'll show you all the netlink devices interfaces. It's not an error. It's like in command, it expects you send some kind of configuration of some kind, usually. And then, of course, like I said, your args is set to your special context. And you get your parameters and use the NL for each attribute loop, just like the other case. Now, the most important thing to know in show start is that if you hit an error condition, that special dump context that you allocated, you have to free, and you have to set arg0 to null, or 0 in this case, because it's a long. So you have to clean up any memory, because otherwise it will report a link, because I found that out with Oleg, and Oleg's like, oh, it's leaking all over the place, because I thought it cleaned itself up, but it doesn't clean itself up. You have to clean up and show. And then in the reverse, you have show done. And that one is you find the context, and you have to free it and set the arg0 to 0. And it's important that you set the arg0 to 0. Otherwise, done can be called more than once. Yes, that happened too. I found that out the hard way. I thought, oh, it's only called once. No. So always think that these functions are re-entrant multiple times, all of them. Always keep that in mind, and they don't clean up after themselves. All right, and then here's the dump function itself. And this is probably the most complicated function to retrieve the data. So just like all the others, you have to set up your personal context, your dump context. You have to get it. You also have to set your extended ACK for error reporting. The difference here is you have to retrieve the port ID and the sequence number for the call from the callback. So the reason for this is that every time a message is sent, it has a special sequence that's incremented. So it's +1, +1 every time a message is sent. So you can see what order the messages are sent. In fact, the Netlink API is by default is that if the sequences are out of order, it considers it an error. So if the message gets screwed up, it's going to reject it. It'll say, oh, the data is corrupted because some of the data is happening before this. I do want to bring up that the YAML configuration file at the end that you put in is also mostly order independent. So like you see pure timeout, and remember we saw that one. You can do it in any order, those key mappings in a block. It doesn't care. It also doesn't care if it's there or if it is there. But in the case of dump, the order is going to be whatever you constructed and you receive from kernel space. But that order is not important for like if you ever used it to send it back into the kernel. So, and the port ID is like every time you open the socket, you're given a special port ID. So this knows to send it to that port. So for the ending socket. So you have to have socket details to send to it. So those are the important things to retrieve. Now the YAML handling is broken into key tables and values. So this reduces the message size by a substantial amount. We're not just going to put a YAML configuration and dump it from kernel space. That would be really, really bad and bad form. So what we do is if you look at a YAML file, the key fields change very rarely. So actually, I set up a key table. And that key table is sent once in the header of the messages. And from there, that key table tells you how to interpret the rest of the message. So it's a handshake header file. So because our APIs change all the time, it's sent in the message to say, this is how you're going to read the data that's going to come after me. So that's how it works. So on the very first time you call the dump function, you call on the very first index, you set up the key table. And it's defined in lnet-nl.h. And then you see that a good example is you have a key list, and it's a list of tables. So you have all that's null terminated, so it knows at the end when to stop reading it. So in this case, it's like your standard netlink config. So you have first your netlink properties, your local NI, and your local NI interfaces. So those are the list, and you can see it's like a chain that it reads it. It's a tree, because remember, YAML is tree and netlink is a tree. So if you imagine you're traversing a tree, that's how the key list is done. Does that make sense? So you go down, and then you might go up, but you only go up a little bit, and there's a branch, and then you go up here, and you branch. So that takes a little bit to get a handle around that, because you have to think of you got to imagine a tree inside your head.
Does the code that's running this have to handle that itself? No, it's just going to get a data structure, right?
That's correct.
A tree.
Yes. And the userland library transverses that tree,
yeah,
and says this is
essentially serializing and deserializing.
Yes.
The tree.
Yep.
So you don't have to understand that detail.
Yes. You just have to understand a little bit of, make sure your key list tree is in the right order so you don't make it, because your YAML file will come out looking weird and then you'll be like, why does it look like that? So, and I give an example of like what a tree structure looks like. I modified this one to show like a nesting. So the first thing is you have to say how many attributes are used for your block or sequence. So there's like a number. So like for LNET tunables, you would have the peer timeouts and the peer credits. Those would be each a block. For the attribute type. And so first you have to say how many attributes that you have in that list, and then you create your list, which would be multiple blocks. In each of those blocks, you have the value, the LKP value. That is the key name. So it would be like nidlist or nettype, whatever the key is. And then you have to say how to interpret this key. Is it nested? So all sequences in block in YAML are nested. So that's the key to remember, because they're all arrays. So sequences are arrays, and blocks are treated as an array, but a nested block. But that's the start of a block. Not like each key value pair is considered a nested value. It's just that way every time the YAML file is indented, it sees nested. It says, oh, indent. And then it looks for this key format, which tells you if it's a sequence or if it's a mapping or a flow. It tells you, it gives you hints to know how to present that data in the YAML format. And constructing these trees You don't have to do it. I have created a function that does it. So you just give it a list of your key tables, and it creates the tree for you to send to the packet. So there's a genel, LNET genel send scalar list, and it will actually create that tree for you to send for you. So you do not have to worry about it. So you do it, you send the message to do it for, and the port and the sequence, and of course the generic netlink family. And then you have to do two flags that are special. One is fcreate. That tells you this is there's a new message coming to be created, and this is the header. So that I use the fcreate flag for messages received to know that, hey, this is a whole new data item for YAML. This is a new YAML document, and this is the key list. Later attributes do not have the fcreate flag, because that's part of the original message. And then it's multiple packet. And then, of course, you have your command. And then all these key list table, I usually call it all. I put it in there. And then it parses that and creates the key, the message to send. Does that make sense?
I'm just thinking the whole time, it's like, will I have to do this myself? Or is this like internal handling that is, you know, you're just describing the implementation details?
This is
or
the.
Is this something that, you know, I'm just hoping not, that I, you know, for me to write a new stat value or something like that, if I have to build up all of this stuff? Or is this mainly just focused in on, like, you know, parsing LNET config and other kind of config stuff that is mostly going to be somewhere in the bowels and only does get done once and then it's mostly done?
It so like for the stats, because our stats are almost all identical.
Yeah.
That base patch is used for basically everything. So, but if you want to add new fields, then you modify like the key table. And then you add your new
fields being a new, like, read bytes, write bytes.
Yes, you would add it to, you would update. So in the case of, like, say, most of the time, I'm writing all the initial stuff, but most of the time when you want to, most people are going to want to expand on it.
Yeah.
Then in that case, you want to develop new enum values that you put in the header. Remember I said there's the attribute values. And then you want to put in this new key table, you want to modify it. And then down in below, you're going to add your LNET attributes. And that's the expansion of it. And then all the rest, the for loops and stuff, are going to be already done.
Okay. I was remembering at the beginning of your presentation, I said, this is just going to work. And
I said for user land. For user land. My goal... My goal is to make vendor products super easy to develop.
Yeah.
That's a big thing. It's stat tools. This is.
And then on the flip side, the other thing you're saying, like, is there going to be some way or like compile time check or something that you know, make sure that the enums match up with the stats, right? So that we don't let somebody who doesn't understand this stuff doesn't add in some stats values, but then they don't update the enum, and so if you read it via proc or sysfs or debugfs, it's showing these new stats, but if you read it via netlink, they don't show up.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. I didn't think of that. Like,
did you think a programmer's not doing everything completely correctly?
Right. I didn't think of, like, keeping the debug stuff in sync with that. That's a good point with those files. And so probably the easiest thing is to make a function for the stats files that reads like these key tables and does an equivalent but into strings instead of netlink packets.
I'm not you could. To one specific thing. It's just like, you know, if there can be a file check or a test or something that just says, hey, you know, because like there was, I can't remember what it was, we were talking about, let's say, the LLSBI flags versus the bits versus the names of all of those flags and stuff like that. And then there are different structures in different places to get out of sync. And so if you stick it all in one place, then it's naturally kept up to date. There's only one place to get it right and wrong.
You're right.
It requires, just like for SBI flags, many commands in the code that says, oh, if you are doing this here, then you would need to update this file as well.
Yeah, you're right. I have to think about that because I have the stats prototype flag patch, but I have to make it so that, the debugging.
Or even if it, you know, something gets generated automatically from something else at compile time.
Yeah.
There's probably not an LSERT, there's a CLSERT or build bug on or something.
Yeah.
The size of this array isn't the size of that array.
Oh, yeah, that could be easily done with the enums and stuff, yes. Yeah, you could easily do that. That's not hard.
Yeah, I don't mind, you know, having to update a couple of places. It's just that if that silently becomes out of sync, right, and it gets back to the same, if you take a value out of the enum and those numbers change, you say, I don't care about that, but in fact, you know, if they silently become out of sync, then it's still wrong, you know, even though it's not an error.
Right.
From the parser point of view, it's...
Right. That's why when you had that discussion with me, I was like, this has to be internal. So that way the kernel code and the enums, they're only thing that have to be kept in sync. Not userland doesn't care. It can't care. And if userland wants to parse automatically, that's their prerogative, but they have to make sure, like, they're doing the right thing if they wanted to do their own API. All right, so that's the dump function.
Are you close to
finish? Yes, I am close to finish. I know, look, last two slides. I know it's so complicated.
It's pretty interesting.
Okay, so when you create your dump data for your attributes, the netlink message is created for each top level item. So basically, there's a message for each item. Like lcuddledl prints out each OBD device. So each OBD device would be a message. Each message is constructed separately, but all the message
attributes for each item.
Yes, because otherwise we would end up with this one message that could be really huge.
The whole original problem.
Yes, but here we're splitting it up to send bits and pieces. And the reason is I'm trying to avoid allocations for each data item. We can have memory allocations if we have tons of data items. That's okay. So one device is placed into each message. The same with LNET, the LNET command stuff. Each network interface, network, you know, TC0 or O2IB0, they're all placed into their own message buffer. And they're all placed into the SK buffer, multiple messages. So that way, it's a huge message that comes at you, but we can handle with the F multiple flag to break that up. So, but the thing is the key is when you go in that for loop in the dump, you have to keep track of where you are in the iteration because you might run out of and need to allocate more memory to resize the SK buffer. So you go out of the function and then come back in and start allocating more. So for each message that you create, there's a genel message put, and then you do the same thing. It's the command, the port, the sequence. That's the start of the message. And it ends with genel message end. That's when you end your message, and you do your for loop over your devices or your network interfaces, and you do that for those two functions. And in case of the failure, you have to call a function called nlmessage cancel, and you set the nl set error message. So you tell what the error is, it'll cancel the message and do all the cleanup for you. Special trick for our YAML API, when you see your YAML files, it says net, colon, and then the data, you don't see colon, net colon, net colon, net colon through the message. So we actually have a special field for your very, very first enum at the very top of your message called adder header. And that adder header, when you have an index of one, when the first time you create it, you put a string of an empty string. Because that overrides it. And so I've added a functionality, as I said, keys don't normally change. There are instances where the keys do change. You can actually change the keys. You can tell the library, you have your cache keys on in your user in the library, and then later on a message will come and say, oh, you need to update key number 5 to this new value. And that's what that's doing. To avoid printing it, it says, oh, it's a null string now, so don't print it. So the very first item is always the netlink is always the group netlink group name. You only print that once ever. So you can also use this like for netlink like for luster stats. The first field in the that flow array we have of the data, that's always changing. So actually, I use the enum type. There's two for strings. There's an NL string and then there's an LN null string. And I use that to differentiate keys and values.
Okay. So, I mean, one thing actually I was wondering when I was looking at this, I mean, currently the luster, you know, stats output format is just kind of mishmashy, made up text before YAML existed, right?
Right.
And so I'm wondering, I mean, if you're emitting this from, you know, netlink, and you're getting the stats, I mean, you just keep it as YAML internally, right? There's,
yes.
You don't put it back into ugly text format again on the other side, do you?
No.
No.
Except for the case of backwards compatibility. Because like for when you can't read the debug FS files, yeah. like the lcuttle DL has a nice YAML
well,
for
it. Because it's emulating that command. But I mean, when you parse it, you know, you want to put it into collectd or whatever.
Correct. Right? It's or in YAML format. Yes.
You just import the YAML directly because why have the overhead of doing it twice?
Yep. So that is correct. That's exactly what it is. So you get the raw YAML, but some of our luster tools convert it to the format that's from before. Oh, and the last thing I want to say, this is my last thing, is there's a LNET LN send error. That's a special thing to use in the debug function. So in newer kernels, remember those error messages I was telling you it sends? Well, in older kernels, it doesn't send it. So that special function I create kind of emulates sending the error message for you. So that's really for just RHEL 8. And also the show dump with the start in show dump, start doesn't exist in older kernels like RHEL 8. It's in newer kernels. So you have to create a special dump that calls start manually.
But we don't need to know all those because you hit that detail for us, right?
No, this is you do need to know this because this is kernel side. I only made user land not suffer.
Okay. I was thinking like you just wrap this up into some configure check and if you're on an old kernel.
Oh, I kind of did that, yes.
API the same inside.
Yeah. It's not too hard to do that, but yes, you have to do a little bit of jumping through hoops. And that's everything. I'm sorry it was so long. It was a huge detail because this is a big change. It's going to affect like projects like the external coordinator, netlink, luster stats. It's a lot of things. So, and of course, I have to do the spiel. DOE sponsored this work, and this is the license and contract. Thank you.
Thank you.
I was